the limelight.
The Americans, though they have resorted to hypocrisy to denounce the latest coup, are no friends of the Muslim people of Sudan. As a matter of fact, the United States, along with the Zionist regime, will never allow Sudan to be a strong and independent Muslim country under an elected civilian government. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading Worsening of the Crisis in Sudan. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Sudan is once again in flames as the military junta, which recently dismissed the interim civilian cabinet, whose survival was actually at the mercy of the generals in uniform, has turned a deaf ear to the democratic demands of the people and is trying to silence them through the barrels of its guns. The recent massive marches by the people in Khartoum and other towns and cities were met by brute military force, resulting in more deaths of the peaceful demonstrators. The pro-Israeli regime junta claimed to seize power from the civilian government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok as a precautionary move to avoid a civil war has been dismissed as lies by the Sudanese people as well as by political analysts abroad. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, an Israeli regime stooge who seized power in 2019 by toppling President Omar Hassan al-Bashir shortly after the latter's visit to Damascus and meeting with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, intends to turn Sudan into a U.S. Zionist base against the wishes of the Sudanese people. The protesting masses say he does not represent the Sudanese Muslim people, who are staunch supporters of the Palestinian people and their cause. They point out that General Burhan takes orders from abroad. This means the protesters demanding civilian rule from the generals who rule it will have to pay a heavy price. In other words, the people should brace for more bullets and greater number of the dead and the wounded to prove they possess the indomitable spirit of sacrifice to change the status quo. It will be a gargantuan task for the Sudanese people, and only time will tell how determined the masses are in the face of the current economic and political crises. This is all indicative of an intricate plot to spread the tentacles of the Zionist regime in Northeast Africa and the Red Sea region. The Americans, though they have resorted to hypocrisy to denounce the latest coup, are no friends of the Muslim people of Sudan. As a matter of fact, the United States, along with the Zionist regime, will never allow Sudan to be a strong and independent Muslim country under an elected civilian government. Under such circumstances, only the iron resolve of the Sudanese masses on the basis of Islam and national solidarity will enable them to deliver their country from the grip of the illegal military junta.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The group was formed to address major issues related to global economy. It is composed of world's largest economies, including Brazil, Britain, China, Germany, India, and the US, among others. These member countries account for 80% of the global GDP, 75% of global trade, and 60% of the world population. But the G20 has been criticized for its limited membership, particularly for its underrepresentation of African countries. There are also disputes over the legitimacy of the G20 and criticisms of its organization and its declarations. The group has failed to address its previous promises, like inequality, social justice, poverty, capitalism, and unemployment. Therefore, the summits are often met with protests, especially by anti-globalization groups. This year, the G20 annual summit gathered the international leaders of world's biggest economies for a two-day meeting under the chairmanship of Italy in Rome. The summit was the first in-person meeting in over a year after the 2020 summit was virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Still, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin participated in the summit virtually. The member states addressed several global challenges, such as the pandemic, climate change, spiking energy prices, supply chain disruptions, and so forth. The bloc is under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. These nations account for roughly 80% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. This year's event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment. In fact, wealthy nations such as the US have implemented a Me First policy by stockpiling vaccine doses and offering booster shots, while many poor countries are still waiting to receive their first COVID jabs.
Well, they have failed to end inequality, to end poverty, and to slow and change the trajectory of climate change because the leaders of these governments simply don't care about those things.
After Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have urged Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, US President Joe Biden, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have called on Iran to, quote, change course. That's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year, but started cutting back on them in response to the US abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it's ready to restart negotiations in late November. but wants to see the verifiable removal of sanctions as an outcome of the talks. Washington, on the other hand, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions on Friday, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement.
They will justify it by saying that Iran wouldn't come back to the bargaining table. They will not look at the fact that it was the United States that withdrew, and the United States that must make the first major move to resurrect this agreement. But this summit is certainly a place where many, many discussions occur, many issues are on the table to be resolved. The situation with U.S. violations of JCPOA is certainly one of them, but it is being ignored.
Iran has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. Meanwhile, Tehran has time and again stated that its nuclear program is peaceful, and it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran's stance is clear: effective removal of anti-Iran sanctions and the normalization of economic and trade ties with the country. Iran requires guarantees that the other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will not break their promises once again.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced a dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued. But that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Said Khatibzadeh, raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup. That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan, the UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to the more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this is why it's important to stress that it is not a given that the UAE, Saudi, and Egypt will support this coup. It's not a given that they are lobbying on behalf of Abdel Fattah Burhan.
But it appears that the Sudanese are determined to continue their protests, as they have done in the past few years, until their demands are met.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Kordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is... If any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world, so they really don't understand criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Kordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansar Allah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who is a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, the Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
Iran's capital, Tehran, hosted a meeting on its neighboring country, Afghanistan. The top diplomats of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan have attended the gathering in person, while the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers were present online. The UN chief also sent a message to the summit online.
We need to keep engaging to help move things in the right direction. Force Afghans and the region also need a country that is secure, not one that is a haven for terrorism or a center for drug trafficking. This is vital to peace and stability in the region and around the world. Excellencies, these are all issues on which the region has a shared interest and on which all of us must speak with one voice. We can only achieve more stability with a united approach. Together, let us act with determination and without delay to help the people of Afghanistan and to secure a better future for all.
The conference took place a week after the third meeting of the Moscow Format Consultations on Afghanistan was held in the Russian capital. The Tehran meeting is aimed at stepping up collaborations between Afghanistan's neighboring countries and creating lasting peace there. Iran has always strongly advised against the interference of foreigners in Afghanistan's affairs and respected the country's independence and territorial integrity. It has also urged the formation of an inclusive government in the country.
In Afghanistan, we are facing a situation that in order to reach an acceptable point for all Afghans, we still have a long way ahead of us.
Amir Abdullahian said this is a joint press conference with the visiting Pakistani counterpart, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, in Tehran. He added that Iran was pursuing contacts with all neighbors to Afghanistan to make sure the utmost use of capacities was achieved at its border crossings for trade and humanitarian aid delivery. The United States is a major factor in the current mess in Afghanistan. The U.S. military led the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001 in what it proclaimed was a war on terror, meant to eradicate the Taliban. 20 years on, in mid-August this year, the Afghan government and military collapsed in the face of the Taliban's swift advances on the ground, which many attribute to a hasty withdrawal of U.S.-led occupation forces from the country. The UN World Food Program says 3.2 million children under 5 are close to acute malnutrition. Afghanistan is now on the brink of bankruptcy. The U.S. has frozen $10 billion of the country's assets in a bid to bring poor and war-weary Afghans to their knees. The resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group on the back of the U.S. exit has created fresh security challenges for the Taliban-ruled country. It's believed that the presence of Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan perfectly serves the interests of Americans.
Well, yeah, Islamic State has been used by the U.S., as has Al-Qaeda inside Syria. So they use these proxies to destroy the stability of countries.
Afghanistan lies at the crossroads of South and Central Asia. It has been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, which killed scores of people, most of them were Shia worshippers. There are reports that in the months before the U.S.-led coalition forces left the country, thousands of terrorists made their way to Afghanistan from Central Asia, North Caucasus, Pakistan, and China's Xinjiang region. Most of them were recruited by Daesh.
Every indication is that the U.S. will try, which is why this inclusive government is needed to resist such abilities to drive a wedge in society.
These foreign terrorists slipped into the country under the nose of U.S. and NATO forces. The American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out the threat of terrorism, but further fanned its flames.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you might remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations on supporting the oppressed and fighting the oppressors, especially the global arrogance and Zionism. We will continue the discussion in this episode. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in his testament stresses that one of the main problems of the Islamic countries and oppressed nations are the mercenary regimes of these countries. He believes that these regimes try to keep these nations weak, backward, and dependent. He writes, at least for the recent 100 years, that the big world devouring powers gradually put their steps in the Islamic countries and other small countries, we have witnessed or have been told by correct histories that none of the ruling governments in these countries have thought of their nation's freedom, independence, and welfare. Almost all of them have rather been engaged in oppression and suffocation of their nation, or have only tried for their vested or group interests, or for the welfare of the wealthy and upper class, and the oppressed slum habiting classes have been denied all life blessings such as water and bread, and those miserable have been employed for the interest of the wealthy and debauchee stratum, or they have been the puppets of big powers, which have employed whatever they can to make countries and nations dependent, and have made countries the markets of the East and the West through different tricks, and have secured their interest and have raised nations backward and consumers, and they are moving with the same plan. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "The misery for Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West, and I emphatically recommend you not to listen to the propaganda horns of the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic, which all try to expel Islam from the scene so that the interests of the superpowers are secured." Imam Khomeini also writes, "O you, the oppressed of the world, and you, the Islamic countries and Muslims of the world, stand up and grasp the right with hands and teeth, and do not be scared of the propaganda ballyhoo of superpowers and their servile stooges, and expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And you and the committed serving classes take the helms of affairs and gather together under the flag of Islam to rise up for defense against the enemies of Islam and the deprived of the world." Imam Khomeini believed that confronting the media hype of the oppressive powers is the main duty of Muslims. He writes, "Today and in the future, what must be important for the Iranian nation and the Muslims of the world is the foiling of the disuniting and destructive propaganda." Elsewhere in his testament, the Imam writes, "I recommend Muslims, particularly the Iranians in the current era, to show reaction against conspiracies, increase their solidarity and unity in any possible way, and disappoint the disbelievers and the hypocrites." Imam Khomeini says, "The prominent ulema and respectable preachers of the Islamic countries should invite governments to free themselves of dependence of big powers and come to mutual understanding with their nation, as in this way they will embrace victory. And let them invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to Islam. And let them shake the hands of fraternity with their brothers in faith in any country and from any race, because the great Islam has called them brothers. And if this brotherhood in faith materializes through the efforts of governments and nations with the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power in the world, with the hope of the day on which, God willing, this fraternity and equality will materialize. Imam Khomeini also writes, I recommend the Islamic nations to take the role model of the Islamic Republic government and the Iranian struggling nation to put the oppressive governments in their place. If they do not capitulate to the will of their nations, the source of misery of Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, got into trouble in May 2018 when then-US President Donald Trump unilaterally abandoned it and reimposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In January this year, when Trump's successor, Joe Biden, took office, he expressed willingness to return to the deal. Accordingly, Tehran and the remaining JCPOA parties, namely China, Russia, the UK, France, and Germany, began talks in Vienna in April. Six rounds of negotiations were held before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. Now, Iran's foreign minister has questioned that whether the US is serious to return to the JCPOA.
If there is a serious will in Washington to return to the deal, there is no need for all these negotiations at all. It is enough for the US president to issue an executive order tomorrow and announce that the US is joining the pact from the point where the Trump administration left.
On Friday, the US imposed fresh sanctions targeting Iran's drone program, a move drawing a reaction from the Iranian Foreign Ministry.
The imposition of new sanctions reflect the completely contradictory behavior of the White House, an administration that talks about returning to the JCPOA and is following the same methods of the Trump administration by imposing sanctions, is sending a message that it is not trustworthy at all.
Iran's drone program, along with its missile program, is among issues that the US and some of its Western and regional allies say must be included in talks over the JCPOA. That's what Iran has time and again rejected, saying its defense program remains non-negotiable.
Iran's defense capability is a matter of national decision that is intertwined with the country's national interests and security. Therefore, no country has the right to speak or comment on this issue.
Iran says it is interested in continuing the Vienna talks, but the negotiations must be result-oriented and lead to the removal of the sanctions in a verifiable manner. However, the White House persists in exerting pressure on Iran to speed up the talks, a policy that Russia believes is unhelpful.
Pressure on Iran to speed up the experience shows that it doesn't help. Doesn't help. Either you do it bilaterally or in the Commission, or you do it through the IAEA.
Top officials within the Biden administration, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have admitted that the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by Trump against Iran has failed. However, despite the admission, the White House seems to be still following up that proven failed policy.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians are lining up in front of the Chambers of Commerce across the Gaza Strip, hoping to get permits from the Israeli side to walk in the occupied lands and the West Bank. This comes after rumors saying that more permits are set to be issued for the first time following the recent escalation on the Gaza Strip.
It is hard to believe that Israel is going to issue permits for us to work in occupied lands and the West Bank. Since 2019, no permission has been issued by Israel. We have been jobless since then. Now Israel says it is going to issue new permits, but it has set hard conditions for us.
In light of the deteriorating economic situation in Gaza with the high unemployment rate of more than 53% and poverty reaching about 70%, Palestinians hope to obtain the permits to find work opportunities in the occupied lands and the West Bank that will help them to reduce their poverty. Since Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005, it no longer allowed Gaza workers to obtain permits that would enable them to work, as tens of thousands of workers used to go out daily to work in the occupied lands as their only source of income in the fields of construction, agriculture, industry, and tourism.
The Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip has led to an unprecedented level of unemployment in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, about 70% of Palestinian families suffer from lack of food, and this is all due to the collapse of Gaza's economy.
The Chamber of Commerce says Israel should be held accountable for the growing rate of unemployment in Gaza. The daily hardships endured by Palestinians, along with the crippling blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, led thousands to search for work opportunities outside Gaza. Palestinians called on the international community to end the siege and develop solutions to reduce high rates of poverty and unemployment. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
A two-day meeting of the G20 leaders of the world's 20 major economies wrapped up in the Italian capital on Sunday. A final communique issued at the end of the summit contains a weak compromise commitment on climate change and COVID-19 vaccine sharing, which has drawn wide criticism from some politicians, activists, and public. Leaders have agreed that nations must take meaningful action to keep the world from warming by no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels without setting any specific criteria to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Furthermore, although the communique does include plans to end overseas investment in coal this year, no specific actions to limit domestic coal use has been set out.
The latest United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report shows that we must carry out immediate, rapid, and sizable cuts to emissions to avoid disastrous consequences. So some of us are asking why we moved our goalpost from 2 degrees to 1.5 degrees. Why? Because science says so.
The G20 leaders have also agreed to establish a 15% global minimum corporate tax for the biggest multinationals in a bid to end the damaging race to the bottom on corporate taxation. However, no developing or poor nations will benefit from this ruling, as multinationals have their bases in wealthy countries and large companies will continue to generate revenue in poorer parts of the world. A long-debated web tax on digital giants such as Apple, Google, and Facebook has been scrapped.
Lately, the G20 summit seems to have lost its relevance, with leaders of several countries, including China, Russia, Japan, and Mexico, not attending the meeting. During anti-G20 rallies, protesters have slammed the summit and the statements that follow, saying that such initiatives are disconnected from reality and people's needs.
The G20 summit talks weekend was accompanied by large protests. Three anti-G20 demonstrations attended by young students, left-leaning groups, climate change activists, and trade unions were held in Rome between Friday and Saturday.
The G20 is made up of politicians who want the finance to take over politics, politicians who want our country in the hands of Brussels, Frankfurt, and the Silicon Valley.
Many fear that the G20 leaders' mild pledges on climate neutrality and coal financing could result in lost momentum ahead of an upcoming crucial COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. Max Civili, Rome.
Her name means hope in Arabic. 3 years ago, a photograph of Amal Hussein showing her skin and bones sparked shock and anger across the globe. A week later, she starved to death and became a striking symbol of the catastrophic situation in the war-torn country.
The number of malnourished cases is increasing daily compared to previous years during a brutal aggression against our country. We expect that the number of malnourished children exceeds 1 million across the country. Amal Hussein was only an example of the suffering of millions of Yemeni children. What is the fault of Amal and these children who suffer from the consequences of the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia? It is the children who pay the price, unfortunately, under the coverage of the United Nations.
Amal was one of nearly 2 million children suffering from severe malnutrition in Yemen. With 3 years having passed since her death, the situation has not got any better due to the continuing food crisis in the country and the lack of medicines for children.
We receive patients from all governorates, including very bad cases that suffer from extreme poverty and are unable to provide the most basic needs of children with their medicine or food. The organizations say they provide everything, but what they receive is very little compared to what they need. And it is difficult to get medicines for malnutrition. Some parents get forced to leave the center before the treatment ends, and as a result, a large number of children die, as what happened to the child Amal Hussein back in 2018.
The years-long Saudi war and siege on Yemen have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Amal has died, but the hope is still alive for millions of Yemeni children who continue to suffer from the consequences of the ongoing brutal Saudi war. However, the international community, including the United Nations, has not taken any action to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the war-ravaged country. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana.
Russian officials reported 40,993 new infections on Sunday, exceeding the previous record of 40,251 reported earlier. They also added that 1,160 people died of the virus on Saturday, three fewer than the record set on Friday. Russia's COVID-19 death count has raised to 237,380, by far the largest in Europe. Meanwhile, over 8.47 million infections have been recorded in the country of 146 million.
Most enterprises and non-essential services in Russia are closed till November the 7th, but the possibility to extend the quarantine is very likely, as it has already happened before.
In Moscow, severe restrictions have begun earlier. Almost the entire service sector is on lockdown. Schools and universities' classes have been closed as well. To cope with infection, President Putin ordered a non-working period from October 30th to November the 7th, when most state agencies and private businesses are to suspend operations.
I just don't understand what's going on. We have a reliable, effective vaccine, and there are only two ways to get through this period: get sick or get vaccinated.
Despite the ever-increasing growth of infections and endless semi-restrictions, some Russians are in no hurry to get vaccinated. Others consider them to be mandatory.
My opinion is very simple. Vaccination is a responsibility act. It should not be a matter of option. It should be mandatory. It's the only way people will be able to beat COVID. As simple as that.
This was not a mandatory part of the program, and people were not forced to do it. Everything could be much better. But when we understand that conditions are being set for us, if you want to work, go get vaccinated. If you want to go to the theater, get vaccinated. If you want to eat in a restaurant, here is a QR code. Get vaccinated. This is already a cattle whip method.
About 51 million Russians, just over a third of the country's people, were fully vaccinated as of Saturday.
They may say anything they want. There are many cases of how severely vaccinated people get sick and die. Why is nobody talking about this?
Observers say one of numerous factors of cited distrust in the authorities' care can be explained by the adopted budget of the new State Duma, where in the next 2 years a reduction in health care costs by 300 billion rubles provided. It seems that plans to treat Russians with vaccines against the background of medicine optimization no longer leave illusions for people. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
While France's weekly protests against the corona vaccine pass have become greatly diminished, probably because Parliament appears certain to approve using the so-called health pass until after next spring's elections, the yellow vests continue to turn out in significant numbers nationwide. For several months, the two groups have often been conflated by the mainstream media, but the anti-vaccine pass protests are organized by a leading far-right politician, while the yellow vests disavow links to any political party, but especially the far right. The yellow vests often march in several different groups in Paris, but they share essentially the same reasons for protesting.
We will be marching every Saturday to demand our human rights and our human dignity. We are here because there is no economic justice in France. France is an oligarchy composed of political elite, union leaders, and high finance. They suck the life and riches out of the real producers of our nation's wealth, the workers.
The yellow vests began 3 years ago in response to record high gas prices. Around Europe, energy prices have just exploded to new records. However, there is even more economic difficulty and instability now than when the yellow vests first took to the streets.
Inflation is at its highest point since 2008. Back then, unemployment was 30% lower than it is today. Economic growth is widely expected to slow dramatically from this quarter onwards. The era of austerity has left France economically unprepared for the coronavirus era, and many believe that social unrest could return to the shocking levels of 2019.
I think what you're seeing is similar to the revolutions which began in Tunisia and sweeped the Arab world. The abuse of human liberty by our government is provoking the same type of conditions in France. They say that there is no more yellow vests. It's not true. We are right here and living on our feet instead of dying on our knees.
French media coverage of the yellow vests diminished to almost nothing in May of 2019. Just 3 weeks into season two, seemingly no domestic media witnessed the demonstrations in Paris. Contrarily, there continues to be an overwhelming police presence of seemingly one heavily armed riot cop for every two protesters, increasing the chances for provocation and violence against unarmed protesters. Ami Mazaheri, Paris.
Saudi Arabia has ordered the Lebanese ambassador to the country to leave over what the kingdom refers to as offensive remarks by the Lebanese information minister regarding the ongoing war by Saudi-led coalition against Yemen. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a ban on all imports from Lebanon. At the same time, the Saudi Foreign Ministry has expressed regret over the deteriorating relations between Riyadh and Beirut, accusing Lebanon of ignorance and failure to take corrective measures to improve the bilateral ties between the two countries. All these came amid a call by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi for an end to the Saudi-sponsored war on Yemen, a devastating war with a simultaneous siege that have been killing and displacing Yemenis for more than 6 years now, a catastrophe that even the United Nations refers to as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Recently, the kingdom also classified a Beirut-based financial charity body as a terrorist entity, froze all the association's assets, and banned all sorts of financial transactions with it, all for the charity's ties with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. Lebanon-Saudi relations have been in free fall for years, but the kingdom's flagrant interference in Lebanon's internal affairs has intensified in the past few years. The highlight of that would be the unexpected resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri during a trip to Riyadh under Saudi degrading treatment and pressure. A year before that, Hariri had reached a power-sharing deal with Hezbollah and had attempted to convince Riyadh of the need to work with the resistance group. In 2016, Saudi Arabia halted $1 billion worth of aid to the Lebanese army, citing the country's regional ties. Those are followed by the latest series of Saudi sanctions against Lebanon, including the prohibition of its citizens from traveling to the country. However, Riyadh does not always act alone. Similar to its conduct in Yemen with regional allies and under Western support, it pressures some other Persian Gulf countries, sometimes through threats and sometimes through leverages, to fill in its footsteps. After controversy over Hariri's resignation, Kuwait and the UAE joined the kingdom to urge their citizens to leave Lebanon. The UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait all summoned their envoys in Lebanon in protest to the recent statements of the Lebanese information minister. In 2017, the very same group of countries, alongside Egypt, collectively severed their ties with Qatar, citing a variety of reasons, including support for terrorism or Qatar's backing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, allegations that were all strongly rejected by Doha. Therefore, one can say that the current Saudi measures against Lebanon, especially at the time of heightened economic instability and insecurity, would do nothing but deteriorate the already worsening crises in the Arab country.
Saudi Arabia has banned all imports from Lebanon after criticisms of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen by Lebanon's Information Minister George Kordahi. The United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Kuwait also summoned their envoys to Lebanon in a protest to Kordahi's comments. The concerted move has sparked outrage in Yemen, where people have unanimously condemned it. Yemenis say Riyadh can't stop the free people from telling the truth about its years-long war on the country.
Saudi Arabia has already violated the principles of Arab solidarity and Arab commercial cooperation and other related covenants issued by the Arab League. This reveals the autocratic nature of Saudi Arabia's rulers. We see a short-sighted approach in Saudi Arabia's foreign policy. The country is seeking to silence any voice against it, whether in Yemen or elsewhere.
Meanwhile, Yemeni officials have called for banning the imports from Saudi Arabia in response to the Saudi halt on Lebanon imports.
Yemenis pay tribute to the stances of Lebanese Minister of Information, George Kordahi. His remarks made in support of Yemenis against the Saudi aggression. There are growing public calls in Yemen to ban Saudi products in solidarity with Lebanon.
In an interview on Monday, Kordahi described the Yemen war as futile and said it was time to end it. He also defended Yemen's Ansarullah movement, saying they were defending themselves against an external aggression.
People, he say they will stand by the Lebanese brothers to stop Riyadh's violations of Lebanon's sovereignty. They called on the free people of the world to support Kordahi for his brave statements amid the continued international apathy toward the Saudi war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz.